So good morning everyone and welcome to this weekend course titled Presenting the Buddhist Path. And Mikko has asked me to use this text, The Foundation of All Good Qualities, which you all have a copy of, to use that as the sort of the structure for the weekend teachings. You've also got a number of other handouts there which we'll be using during this weekend teachings as well. Just a little bit about myself. My name's Glenn Svensson. I was born in Australia, grew up there. I have a Bachelor of Science in IT, so my profession before was in the IT field, so I worked quite a number of years in IT. I did my first course in Buddhism about 20 years ago now, and went on to do a 7-year study program in Buddhist philosophy in Italy. Finished that in 2004, did some retreat, and then for about the last 7 or 8 years I've mainly been based in India, in Tushita, in Dharamsala, teaching there. But also now in the last couple of years I'm starting to move around a little bit more and spending some time in Europe, and now also I'll be in North America after this visit. So that's a little bit about myself. As Mikko mentioned, the schedule, just to run through the schedule very briefly. So this morning we're going to have 2 sessions. And the first one will go till 11:15, and then we'll have a half an hour tea break, morning tea break. And then 11:45 till 1 o'clock. Second session, then, as Mikko mentioned, from 1 till 2:30, we'll have lunch break. Then 2:30 till 3:30 is the session after lunch. Then half an hour afternoon tea break till 4, and then 4 till 5, the last session finishing at 5. Tomorrow's schedule will be the same, except everything's moved forward 1 hour. So we start at 9 till 4, and then lunch will be at 12 till 1:30 tomorrow. Same sessions. And then Monday evening, I think we're starting 6 o'clock till 7:15, half an hour tea break, 7:45 till 9 o'clock. So we're finishing on Monday evening at 9 p.m. So that's the schedule. Materials you've got there we'll be using. One last thing is if you brought mobile phones, make sure you have them switched off. That would be very helpful, not to disturb anyone. And so what I'd like to do before we actually get into the discussion is to start with a short meditation just to prepare the body and the mind so that we're in a good mental and physical state to begin our teaching. So let's start with a short meditation. So make yourselves nice and comfortable. So the most important thing with the posture is to keep the back nice and straight, and at the same time the body completely relaxed, completely at ease. So letting go of any external distractions, allow your awareness to descend into your body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any areas of tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension to the best of your ability. And then bring your awareness to the area of your face. And soften and relax all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And then allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. So not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allow the breath to flow naturally, effortlessly. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, simply releasing them. And then give yourself permission to let go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future for the duration of this short meditation. Letting go of all of these things and simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice any sensations related to the breath. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And if you notice that you've become distracted, then without getting upset, simply relax, happily release the distraction, and very gently return to focusing on the breath. And if you're noticing that you're becoming dull or spaced out, then simply arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. Sharpen that focus. Now you can think about your motivation for coming here this weekend. What do you hope to get out of this weekend? And how would you like to integrate this material into your daily life? And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. To rest in its own place. Simply rest in awareness itself. All sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance and simply rest in luminously clear awareness. Slowly bring the meditation to a close. So we're going to use this text here, the foundation of all good qualities, to as the framework for our discussions about the Buddhist path to enlightenment. But before we go into the text, I think it's going to be very helpful to see or understand how this particular text fits within the big Buddhist picture. So I'd like to spend a bit of time this morning first sort of giving the framework, the background to this text. So when the Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago and became Shakyamuni Buddha, then he spent 45 years wandering around India teaching what he had discovered. And he taught according to people's capacities and needs. And so because of that, we can talk about what's called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, which are sort of three cycles of teachings that he taught according to the different levels of the disciples. So I'd like to begin by presenting that. The very first teaching, in fact, that the Buddha gave after achieving enlightenment was the Four Noble Truths. And he taught that in a place called Sarnath, very close to Varanasi. Four Noble Truths is the framework or foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And in the Four Noble Truths teachings, He was really being like a doctor to us. And in these Four Noble Truths teachings, we can actually use this analogy to help us understand the Four Noble Truths. And the analogy often given here to understand Four Noble Truths is the analogy of a physical illness. And that normally if we think we have some sort of physical illness, what we will, of course, generally do is go to the doctor, because we believe that the doctor is qualified in trying to understand what our problem is and try to hopefully find a cure for that. So when we go to the doctor, of course, the very first thing that they would generally do is a diagnosis. And the diagnosis generally has two parts to it. First, they would examine us to see what sort of condition we're in. So they would maybe take some blood test and check the heart and do other sorts of tests just to see what sort of condition we find ourselves in. Then on that basis, they would then look at all of that symptoms and evidence and then say, well, try to work out what would be the underlying illness that's presenting itself in that way. So to try to determine what is the underlying illness or cause why we're sort of in this unhealthy state. And then on the basis of that diagnosis, then the next step in the process is the prognosis, where the doctor would then tell us what, if anything, we can do about that. And the analogy we're using here is the analogy of a curable illness. So part of the prognosis then would be that the doctor would say, yes, I believe you've got this particular illness, and the prognosis would be we can cure that. You can become healthy again. And then following the prognosis, of course, is then the doctor would prescribe the cure, maybe some medicine, or we have to do some surgery or something. So what we can see then is that we go through these steps in terms of a physical illness. Similarly, the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths teaching is being like our doctor. He is diagnosing what our current condition is. And so in the first of the Four Noble Truths, what did the Buddha say that our condition is? What condition do we find ourselves in? Here, most often in English, this is translated as suffering. And this often creates a lot of confusion. So what you'll find often in Buddhism is that often it's simply the terminology that creates a lot of confusion. Because a lot of the original terms from the Pali and Sanskrit language that were used in these teachings, in English there's no real word that has the same meaning. And so then the translator is forced to pick a word that's sort of similar. And so often then the word here that's being used in English is suffering. But this creates a lot of confusion, because this word suffering in English, of course, when we see this word, for us it generally implies that it's talking about some sort of unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experience. And so then often you hear in Buddhist teachings that in the Four Noble Truths, often people would say, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And then of course when we hear that, we go, that doesn't sound right. You know, sometimes I have quite a lot of happiness in my life. I have joyful, happy experiences. So I think the Buddha didn't really know what he was talking about. And, of course, the Buddha wasn't saying all life is merely physical and mental unpleasant experiences. He never said that. He said the original word here, of course, is dukkha. What the Buddha said was that the human condition is dukkha. What does dukkha really mean? Dukkha has a much more broader meaning than what we would normally associate with the word suffering. And to highlight that, we can talk about a presentation called the three types or three levels of dukkha. And the first level of dukkha is actually suffering. And here this word is implying our unpleasant experiences, our unpleasant, painful, physical or mental experiences. So part of the human condition is in fact that sometimes we do have these sorts of experiences. We know that well, and we all know that this is not something that we really like. This is something we find very unsatisfactory. So this one is sort of fairly obvious to us. But then the Buddha also said that part of the human condition is that we also have pleasant experiences sometimes. And he used the word change here to describe this. And of course, the reason he used the word change here to describe our pleasant experiences is exactly that. They change. They come to an end. That our pleasant experiences are simply temporary, transient experiences. And that also, of course, not only are they temporary or transient, but they require some stimulus to be present. We can't just sort of click our fingers and have a pleasant experience whenever we want one. They require some stimulus to be there. If the stimulus is not there, we won't have the pleasant experience. And when the stimulus is gone, the pleasant experience is finished. But also, of course, what we can understand here is that these pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness, because normally that's what we do. We equate pleasure or pleasant experiences with happiness. But our pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness. Because if they were, it would mean the more we engaged or indulged in that pleasant experience, the more happy we should become. And we know from our own experience that's not the case, you know. If we like chocolate cake, it's not that if we eat more chocolate cake, we get more happy. In fact, if we eat too much chocolate cake, we feel sick. So these pleasant experiences are simply relative experiences, relative to a previous state. They're an improvement, but if we overindulge in them, they often then turn into suffering themselves. So this is what here is meant by this word change, is that our pleasant experiences are simply stimulus-based, temporary, they're relative experiences, and they're unreliable, meaning we can't just have them whenever we want them. So this often is what we chase after in this pursuit of happiness. But here the Buddha was saying, well, this is never really going to fulfill you. You're never really going to find fulfillment or lasting happiness, because in its very nature, pleasant experiences are temporary, transient, relative experiences. In that sense, they are dukkha. But at a deeper level, there's something else going on in the human condition. And here the Buddha described this as all-pervasive dukkha, meaning that underlying both our pleasant and unpleasant experiences is this all-pervasive conditioning, in that there's always a potential for some sort of problem or suffering to arise in our life. You know, we can't just go somewhere or be somewhere and be completely free of that potential of suffering. That's what all pervasive means. All pervasive, of course, means pervading everywhere. It is that the human condition is such that there's always this potential for some sort of suffering to arise in our life. In that sense, our human condition is unsatisfactory because there's always that potential there. Why is that potential there, of course, is because our mind is contaminated. Our mind is contaminated by the mental afflictions. As long as we have anger and jealousy and craving and fear, anxiety, depression, as long as we have these sorts of mental afflictions in our mind, there's always the potential for some sort of suffering to arise. So this is what the Buddha was really saying is the human condition. This is what sort of dukkha is indicating, all of that, not just that our life is simply unpleasant experiences. So to avoid this confusion then, in translation, sometimes translators will translate this as instead of suffering here, you'll see something like unsatisfactory. So if someone were to say to you that according to Buddhism, human life is unsatisfactory, then you might think, maybe let's check. You know, maybe that could be true. Let's look at that. And so, of course, what the Buddha found in his diagnosis was, why are we stuck in this unsatisfactory state of dukkha? And that was the second noble truth. The truth of the cause of dukkha or suffering. And here, the Buddha pinpointed two elements, two things. And that is our mental afflictions. So the mental afflictions, of course, are things like attachment and anger and jealousy and craving and anxiety. These mental afflictions are what is driving our behavior. And our actions have consequences. And so this action, of course, in Sanskrit is karma. This Buddhist principle of cause and effect in terms of our actions leading to our experiences. Of course, this is one of the topics we'll be covering in this weekend in some more detail. And within these mental afflictions, as we're going to see, is why is it that we have anger and jealousy and craving and so forth in the first place? Why are they there? And what the Buddha discovered was that what is underlying all of those is what's called ignorance, our fundamental ignorance, our misunderstanding of how we exist and how the world around us exists. We overinflate this sense of me and the world, and we're grasping onto a wrong way of seeing ourselves and the world in terms of how we exist. This is leading to these mental afflictions, driving our behavior, which is leading to our experiences of dukkha. So these is the Buddha's diagnosis. Then, of course, what he said in his prognosis was that we can be cured of this state. So the third noble truth is the truth of cessation. The truth of the ending of dukkha or suffering, that we can achieve a healthy state, completely free of this state of dukkha. The reason being was that the Buddha found that these mental afflictions and ignorance that are the underlying source are not part of the nature of our mind, that these are just like dirt covering the surface of the mind. And we can eliminate these mental afflictions and ignorance from our mind and thereby eliminating the underlying illness or cause, we eliminate the result, dukkha or suffering. And we can achieve then a cessation, an ending of all suffering and its causes. And this state here of cessation is a state of liberation from suffering, often referred to in Buddhism as a state of nirvana. But then, of course, the Buddha went on to prescribe the cure. How can we become healthy? How can we achieve state of nirvana, a state completely free of suffering, of dukkha? And so in the cure is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So here in the path, the Buddha taught what's, and we're going to look at this a little bit more detail later, this noble eightfold path. Basically eight instructions on what we are to do, eight different practices to achieve this healthy state of nirvana. And within those eightfold path, the noble eightfold path, then we, if we look at that, we can see that actually all of those eight things we can condense into three main areas of practice. Which are called the three higher trainings. The first of those is ethics. And as we're going to see in this text, in the foundation of all good qualities, that ethics is really the foundation of all the Buddhist levels of practice. Whatever level of practice we are engaging in within Buddhism, the foundation of that is ethics. Ethics, of course, can be simply abandoning non-virtuous harmful actions, but ethics, as we're going to see, can be also more proactive in terms of not only stopping negative actions, but the ethics of in helping others and the ethics of engaging in virtuous actions as well. The second core area of practice is concentration. Because as we're going to see, to achieve this healthy state, we need to overcome our mental afflictions and ignorance. To overcome that, we need to develop wisdom, which is the third of the three practices. But this wisdom we need to develop is not just some wisdom intellectually understanding how we exist and the world exists. That's not enough. We need to be able to directly see this nature of reality in meditation. To be able to directly realize how I exist and the world exists in meditation, we need a very stable, clear, and focused mind. Otherwise, we're not going to get there. So this is the concentration practice, is simply developing a calm, clear, focused mind. Because we're trying to transform our mind. We're trying to overcome our negative habits. We're trying to develop our positive habits. We're trying to penetrate the nature of reality. So if we want to do this, we need a very stable, clear, focused mind to be able to transform the mind. Therefore, concentration practice is essential, developing single-pointed concentration. So we're going to be looking at this in a little bit more detail later in the text as well. And then, of course, the third main area of practice is wisdom. And here, of course, wisdom, we're talking about particularly the wisdom realizing the nature of reality. Often this wisdom practice in Sanskrit and Pali is, or in Sanskrit is called Vipassana. Probably many of you are more familiar with the Pali term, which is Vipassana. In these words, the VI part of the word means higher or beyond. And passion or pasana means to see. So vipassana or vipassana means higher seeing or seeing beyond. Normally this is translated into English as insight or special insight. And so we see in the Foundation of All Good Qualities text later, it talks about developing this special insight, which, of course, we're talking about this wisdom practice. Now, here, in the Four Noble Truths teachings, then what the Buddha identified as the problem, the underlying ignorance, is that we overinflate the sense of me. We believe that the me that is here seems to exist in a more solid way than it really is. We overinflate the sense of me, and we grasp onto this false sense of me, which is referred to in Buddhism as self. So here, the problem is grasping onto this self, this overinflated sense of me. So then in the path, the cure is to realize there's no such self. So therefore, in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, in this Four Noble Truths teachings, then the wisdom that we need to develop is what's called the wisdom of selflessness or no self. But of course, no self doesn't mean no me. No Buddhist tradition says there's no me. All the Buddhist traditions are is investigating, how do I exist? How does the world around us exist? And they're all saying that we are overinflating the sense of me. And so here, we need to realize that there is no such self. And it's our grasping onto this belief that there is this self that is leading to all of our mental afflictions and then all of our suffering. So here in the Four Noble Truths teachings, the Buddha said the problem is simply how we see ourselves as a person. We falsely overinflate the sense of me. That's the problem. And implicitly then, what's being said here is that how we see the world, not a problem. That there is really an objective world out there. And so what we can say here in that sense is that everything is real. Real here means there is an independent objective world that exists as it appears to us. How we see the world, there is no problem. The problem is simply how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me. That's the problem. So this is what the Buddha taught here. And this is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. But then the Buddha went on to teach what's called the second turning of the wheel of Dharma in a place called Rajagiha, which is not so far from Bodh Gaya, where he achieved enlightenment. And in the second turning of the wheel, the Buddha said, actually, there's a deeper level of ignorance than just this. That actually, here he said, how we see the world is false as well. That everything is deceptive, that there is no independent objective world there. There is no independent subjective me here. So here, he said that nothing is real. Meaning, nothing exists in the way it appears to us. Even though there appears to be this independent objective world and an independent subjective me here, this is an illusion. And so therefore, That then brings us to this idea of emptiness. An emptiness here, or in Sanskrit, shunyata, is that things are empty of existing in this way. There is no independent reality. That there is no independent subjective me, no independent objective world. So he taught this idea of emptiness. But also here, he taught that not only in the Four Noble Truths, of course, the goal is personal liberation, nirvana. So together with the selflessness idea, we have the idea of nirvana, personal liberation. That by realizing this, we can achieve nirvana. But here, the Buddha was saying that actually there's a further goal of enlightenment. So not only did he teach a deeper understanding of reality, but he also taught a more vast path in terms of striving not just for the personal goal of nirvana, but the further goal of enlightenment. So here then, together with emptiness, we have this idea of bodhicitta. And with bodhicitta and emptiness, then those two things together, we can then achieve the goal of enlightenment. But bodhi is Sanskrit for enlightenment and citta is mind. So bodhicitta is the mind of enlightenment. So it's the mind which aspires to enlightenment. So we see here in these teachings this idea of emptiness and the idea of bodhicitta, and then the goal is enlightenment. So this is what the Buddha taught in the second turning of the wheel. But then, of course, if we look at particularly this idea of emptiness, that nothing exists independently, if we look at that, we may come to the conclusion that, well, it seems like the Buddha's saying here nothing really exists. You know, nothing has its own unique nature. And so it's easy to misinterpret this to mean nothing exists. So it's easy, with trying to understand this, to fall to the extreme of nihilism, thinking that nothing exists. Misinterpreting that nothing is real, meaning nothing exists. But of course, that's not what the Buddha was saying. So to help avoid falling to that extreme of nihilism, we have the third turning of the wheel. Which is often to find distinction. And this is mainly taught in an area called Vaishali in India. And in there, the Buddha was basically to avoid misinterpreting that this means nothing really exists. Then he effectively said, some things are real. Because here, we are saying that there is no independent objective world, that the world is really a product of our mind. It's a projection of the mind. But then, of course, we're also saying the mind is not real, so therefore it seems like nothing can exist. So to avoid that misinterpretation, the Buddha said some things are real. Meaning, yes, there is no independent external world out there, but the mind is real because everything's coming from the mind, so the mind is something you can hold on to as real. So to help people avoid that extreme of nihilism. So here, of course, he also taught the idea of emptiness, but here the emptiness is different. The emptiness here is that there is no external world. That there appears to be this external world, material world, but actually if we investigate, we'll come to realize that this is of the nature of the mind. It's actually internal to the mind. And they use the example of a dream to highlight this. You know, now when we're dreaming, in the middle of the dream, you know, things really do appear very solid and real, and we believe that in the dream, and we behave as if that's the case. But if we become lucid in the dream, then of course the world in the dream will still appear to be material external, but we, because we're lucid now, we'll realize this appearance is deceiving us, that this dream world is simply internal to the mind. So they say that likewise, if we realize emptiness, we'll come to realize that even though this world appears to be a material external world, we'll come to realize actually it's internal to our mind, just like in a lucid dream. So this is what emptiness is taught here, is that there is no external world. It's internal to the mind. And we have the same idea of bodhicitta here as well, and the idea of enlightenment. So this is the third turning of the wheel. Any questions about any of those points? So this is just a very brief overview, of course. There's a lot more we can say about these. But actually, what we're going to find is in this text, a number of points in the text are going to be covering some of the things that I've mentioned. But is there any confusion about what I've covered so far? Anything not clear? Happy or completely confused? No questions? Okay. From these teachings that the Buddha gave, what we find is that after the time of the Buddha, we have various philosophical systems evolving in ancient India based on these different sets of teachings. So I'd like to briefly present that before we go into the text so we can, that will help us as well. So the Four Noble Truths teachings were the teachings that really were taught widely and really took hold in India a lot at the time of the Buddha. And from those teachings, we actually have two philosophical schools evolving. The first school, the Vaibhashika school, was actually the philosophical systems that really started to develop pretty well soon after the time of the Buddha. And we have a number of different sort of slight variations of understanding. In fact, this Vaibhashika system is often said to be like a collection of 18 sort of sub-schools that have very similar understandings. And it's from this Vaibhashika, very early philosophical systems that form the basis of what's now called the Theravada traditions. Which we're going to talk a little bit more about after the morning break. But also from this first turning of the wheel of Dharma, we have another philosophical system that sort of evolved some centuries later. Called the Sautrantika school. This really started to evolve around the 4th century through a great Indian master called Vasubandhu. So it was Vasubandhu from his works that we had this Sautrantika school starting to develop in ancient India, with some differences to the Vaibhashika, but both of them are based on the first turning of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths teaching. So in both of these philosophical systems, they talk about no self and the goal of nirvana. But there are some differences in their assertions. So these are the two systems that develop from the first turning of the wheel. Then we have the third system, called the Chitta Matra, or often translated into English as mind only school. And that also developed around the same time as Sautrantika through a great Indian master, Asanga, who was the half-brother of Vasubandhu. And this comes from the third turning of the wheel. You know, this idea that there is no external world, that the world is internal to the mind. Hence the word chittamatra, mind only, that everything's are of the nature of the mind. So this is the philosophical system that really developed from the third turning of the wheel. Then we have also, from the second turning of the wheel, we have a philosophical system developing. Called the Majjhimika or Majjhimika philosophical system. And this really started to develop in ancient India by a great Indian master called Nagarjuna in the 2nd century. And he really wrote a classic text called The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. Based on the second turning of the wheel teachings in Rajgir, the idea of emptiness. Those teachings are called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings. And some of you may be familiar, for example, with the Heart Sutra. Heart Sutra is one of those Perfection of Wisdom teachings in the second turning of the wheel. And this resulted in the Majjhimika philosophical system being developed through the efforts of Nagarjuna in the 2nd century. But then what we find is that this philosophical system, which is the one we are sort of following in this foundation of all good qualities, that this is this idea of emptiness here, you know, there's no independent subjective me, there's no independent objective world. This view is very difficult to appreciate, to understand. So much so that even the great Indian masters following Nagarjuna, sometimes came up with a different interpretation. And because of that, we actually have two sub-schools of Majjhimika developing based on different understandings of Nagarjuna's work. So we have schools called Svatantrika and Prasangika. So some of you maybe who've studied a little bit about this emptiness have probably heard this word Prasangika, because this is the interpretation or the way of understanding emptiness that is accepted in all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. And this sort of split came primarily from two great Indian masters. That first we have a Indian master in the 6th century called Buddha Palita, who wrote a commentary on Nagarjuna. explaining what Nagarjuna was saying here. But then just after that time, we have another great Indian master, Baba Viveka, who sort of looked at Buddha Pallita's work and said, no, 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 you didn't understand what Nagarjuna was saying. Nagarjuna was really saying this. So he has a slightly different interpretation of what Nagarjuna was saying. And so we have these two sub-schools with slightly different understanding. And so what we're going to do in this foundation of all good qualities is that we are going to be following this understanding here, the Prasangika understanding. And so we generally within all the Tibetan traditions, this is the philosophical view out of all of these four schools that is accepted and followed. So these are the four philosophical systems that evolved through as a result of the three turnings of the wheel of the teachings of the Buddha. Any questions about these four philosophical systems? Again, this is a very brief introduction. Anyone have any questions about any of those? Yeah.
Yes. Can I add? Then, if the Tibetan school is, or the Tibetan Buddhism is following the Prasangika school, and how about the Svatantrika school?
Svatantrika.
Yes.
Yeah. Again, see, what you'll find is that here, these are what's called tenet systems, philosophical assertions, and various schools follow certain systems, but what we have to understand is within that, of course, an individual practitioner may or may not be following that. They may, through their own experience, come to a different conclusion. So, for example, the Theravada traditions, which I'm going to talk about after the break, are originally based on this philosophical view. But there may be many Theravada practitioners now who actually, in through their own meditative experience, are coming to this conclusion. This is possible. So, you know, within an individual, just because you happen to be following a tradition of Buddhism that says, well, this is sort of the view we're following, from our own side, we may not be experiencing that. We may be coming to a different conclusion. So, that's sort of what we need to understand about these philosophical systems. So, as far as I'm aware, I think there are not really any of the Tibetan traditions as a whole that would say this is what we're following. But within that, of course, there may be certain lineages or certain groups of people or individuals who would accept this or maybe even accept this. And certainly this Chittamatra system, particularly, as we're going to see later in the weekend, in the area of tantra practice, actually to sort of adopt this philosophical view as a beginner can be very helpful in breaking down false views. So what we're going to see is that even though we are going to be following this understanding, it's not like this is the correct one, these are all wrong, so let's throw them out. Rather, these are all like stepping stones to come to the most subtle view. So actually, all of these are helpful to us. So we should use what is helpful within them to help us further develop and improve our understanding of reality. And not simply go, well, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist. Tibetan Buddhists follow this. Therefore, I don't accept any of this. Let's just get rid of that and not even try to understand that. That would be a big mistake because this view is so subtle and it's very easy to mouth this view to say, oh, everything's empty of inherent existence. Very easy to say that, rolls off the tongue very easy. But do we really appreciate what that means? Is that our experience really? Probably not. Some of these views here are as a beginner, are a lot easier to relate to and we can work with that. And then we can use these as sort of progressive platforms to come to this understanding. So all of these views, I think, can be very useful to us. So we shouldn't just you know, have this idea that, well, I'm following this view, therefore let's get rid of all of that because that's of no use to me. I think that would be a big mistake from our side.
How does this term Theravada relate to Hinayana?
Okay. Theravada is coming from a Sanskrit word stavira, which is one of these groupings of the 18 subschools. Whereas what we're going to see is that these two schools are talking about the goal of nirvana. These two schools are talking about a further goal of enlightenment. So then what we can say, jnana means vehicle. And the vehicle that can take us to goal of nirvana is called Hinayana. The vehicle that can take us to the goal of enlightenment is called Mahayana. So you would see that these two philosophical systems would belong to Hinayana, and these two would belong to Mahayana. But what you find is within that, then part of these the schools that developed early here, they were the ones that then I think went on to thrive in ancient India and were the basis of a lot of the modern day traditions. So therefore the people in the Theravada traditions would be coming under the umbrella of Hinayana because they have as their goal nirvana. They don't really distinguish between the goal of nirvana and enlightenment. But it's often felt that the word Hinayana is a bit of a pejorative term because Hinayana means lesser. So people don't like that way of categorizing because it seems like they're somehow inferior. But the idea being here between Hinayana and Mahayana is that Hinayana is striving for the initial goal of nirvana, where Mahayana is sort of going to the further goal of enlightenment. So I think, therefore, generally, those following the Hinayana path or the path to nirvana are being commonly known as Theravada. So then we can just use the word Theravada instead. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll take a morning tea break. Yes.
I have one more. Yes. You said that the Madhyamika school is basing its teachings to the second turning, right?
Correct.
Yes. So how about then the third turning? Is it completely like, because it came after the second turning, obviously, and the Buddha thought the third turning for a reason, obviously, then. So in the Madhyamika school, how is the third turning then?
Yeah, as I said, was that the third turning was taught for those people who had the vision of enlightenment but couldn't really appreciate emptiness, that they would misinterpret emptiness to mean that, oh, that nothing really exists and fall to the extreme of nihilism, which of course is not a good place to be. So to help these people who couldn't really appreciate this, then the Buddha taught the third turning of the wheel as a sort of a stepping stone to that,
right,
to that goal. But also what you find, which I didn't mention here, which is not really relevant to this, what we're covering, is there's another part to the third turning of the wheel, which talks about Buddha nature, this idea of Tathagatagarbha in Sanskrit. And this idea of Buddha nature, which is a sort of a separate idea to this, This can be a little bit of a bridge into the deeper level teachings of Tantra or Vajrayana. But that's a sort of separate aspect to the third turning of the wheel. So in that sense, that part of the third turning of the wheel is then a further progression towards Tantra Vajrayana. Whereas this part of the third turning of the wheel is like a sort of step back as a stepping stone to this. So we have those two aspects of the third turning of the wheel. Okay, morning tea time. So we'll break till 11:45, so 25 minute break or 30 minute break. We'll come back then.